The central portion of Sarah, the heart of the house, had stood for almost 100 years and had seen its share of storms. The one that fell on the Lakes region that July afternoon might have been the worst of them, but I knew as soon as we were inside, both of us gasping like people who have narrowly escaped drowning, that it would almost certainly withstand this one as well. The log walls were so thick it was almost like stepping into some sort of vault. The storm's crash and bash became a noisy drone, punctuated by thunderclaps and the occasional loud thud of a branch falling on the roof. Somewhere, in the basement, I guess, a door had come loose and was clapping back and forth. It sounded like a starter's pistol. The kitchen window had been broken by the topple of a small tree, its needly tip poked in over the stove, making shadows on the counter and the stove burners as it swayed. I thought of breaking it off and decided not to. At least it was plugging the hole. I carried Kai into the living room, and we looked out at the lake, black water prinked up in surreal points under a black sky. Lightning flashed almost constantly, revealing a ring of woods that danced and swayed in a frenzy all around the lake. As solid as the house was, it was groaning deeply within itself as the wind pummeled it and tried to push it down the hill. There was a steady, soft chiming. Kyra lifted her head from my shoulder and looked around. "You have a moose," she said. "Yes, that's Bunter. Does he bite?" "No, honey, he can't bite. He's like a dog, I suppose." "Why is his bell ringing?" "He's glad we're here. He's glad we made it." I saw her want to be happy, and then I saw her realizing that Maddie wasn't here to be happy with. I saw the idea that Maddie would never be here to be happy with glimmer in her mind and felt her push it away. Over our heads, something huge crashed down on the roof. The lights flickered and Kai began to weep again. "No, honey," I said, and began to walk with her. "No, honey, no, Kai, don't. Don't, honey, don't. I want my mother. I want my Maddie." I walked her the way I think you're supposed to walk babies who have colic. She understood too much for a 3-year-old, and her suffering was consequently more terrible than any 3-year-old should have to bear. So I held her in my arms and walked her, her shorts damp with urine and rainwater under my hands, her arms fever hot around my neck, her cheeks slathered with snot and tears, her hair a soaked clump from our brief dash through the downpour, her breath acetone, her toy a strangulated black clump that sent dirty water trickling over her knuckles. I walked her. Back and forth we went through Sarah's living room, back and forth through dim light thrown by the overhead and one lamp. Generator light is never quite steady, never quite still. It seems to breathe and sigh. Back and forth through the ceaseless low chiming of Bunter's bell, like music from that world we sometimes touch but never really see. Back and forth beneath the sound of the storm. I think I sang to her, and I know I touched her with my mind, and we went deeper and deeper into that zone together. Above us, the clouds ran and the rain pelted, dousing the fires the lightning had started in the woods. The house groaned and the air eddied with gusts coming in through the broken kitchen window, but through it all there was a feeling of rueful safety, a feeling of coming home. At last her tears began to taper off. She lay with her cheek and the weight of her heavy head on my shoulder, and when we passed the lakeside windows, I could see her eyes looking out into the silver dark storm, wide and unblinking. Carrying her was a tall man with thinning hair. I realized I could see the dining room table right through us. Our reflections are ghosts already, I thought. "Kai, can you eat something?"
"Not hungry."
"Can you drink a glass of milk?"
"No, cocoa. I cold."
"Yes, of course you are, and I have cocoa." I tried to put her down, and she held on with panicky tightness, scrambling against me with her plump little thighs. I hoisted her back up again, this time settling her against my hip, and she subsided.
"Who's here?" she asked.
She had begun to shiver.
"Who's here besides us?"
"I don't know."
"There's a boy," she said. "I saw him there."
She pointed Strickland toward one of the sliding glass doors which gave on the deck. All the chairs out there had been overturned and thrown into the corners. One of the set was missing, apparently blown right over the rail. He was black, like on that funny show me and Maddie watch. There are other black people, too. A lady in a big hat, a man in blue pants. The rest are hard to see. But they watch. They watch us. Don't you see them? They can't hurt us. Are you sure? Are you? I didn't answer. I found a box of Swiss Miss hiding behind the flour canister, tore open one of the packets, and dumped it into a cup. Thunder exploded overhead. Kai jumped in my arms and let out a long, miserable wail. I hugged her, kissed her cheek. Don't put me down, Mike. I'm scared. I won't put you down. You're my good girl. I'm scared of the boy and the blue pants man and the lady. I think it's the lady who wore Maddie's dress. Are they ghosties? Yes. Are they bad, like the men who chased us at the fair? I don't really know, Kai, and that's the truth. But we'll find out. Huh? That's what you thought. But we'll find out. Yes, I said. I guess that's what I was thinking. Something like that. I took her down to the master bedroom while the water heated in the kettle, thinking there had to be something left of Joe's I could pop her into. But all of the drawers in Joe's bureau were empty. So was her side of the closet. I stood Kai on the big double bed, where I had not so much as taken a nap since coming back, took off her clothes, carried her into the bathroom, and wrapped her in a bath towel. She hugged it around herself, shaking and blue-lipped. I used another one to dry her hair as best I could. During all of this, she never let go of the stuffed dog, which was now beginning to bleed stuffing from its seams. I opened the medicine cabinet, pawed through it, and found what I was looking for on the top shelf, the Benadryl Joe had kept around for her ragweed allergy. I thought of checking the expiration date on the bottom of the box, then almost laughed out loud. What difference did that make? I put Kai on the closed toilet seat and let her hold on around my neck while I stripped the childproof backing from four of the little pink and white pills. Then I rinsed out the tooth glass and filled it with cold water. While I was doing this, I saw movement in the bathroom mirror, which reflected the doorway and the master bedroom beyond. I told myself that I was only seeing the shadows of windblown trees. I offered the pills to Kai. She reached for them, then hesitated. Go on, I said. It's medicine. What kind? She asked. Her small hand was still poised over the little cluster of capsules. Sadness medicine, I said. Can you swallow pills, Kai? Sure, I taught myself when I was two. She hesitated a moment longer, looking at me and looking into me, I think, ascertaining that I was telling her something I really believed. What she saw or felt must have satisfied her, because she took the capsules and put them in her mouth, one after the other. She swallowed them with little birdie sips from the glass, then said, I still feel sad, Mike. It takes a while for them to work. I rummaged in my shirt drawer and found an old Harley Davidson tee that had shrunk. It was still miles too big for her, but when I tied a knot in one side, it made a kind of sarong that kept slipping off one of her shoulders. It was almost cute. I carry a comb in my back pocket. I took it out and combed her hair back from her forehead and her temples. She was starting to look put together again, but there was still something missing. Something that was connected in my mind with Royce Merrill. That was crazy, though, wasn't it? Mike? What Kane? What cane are you thinking about? Then it came to me. A candy cane, I said. The kind with stripes. From my pocket, I took the two white ribbons. Their red edges looked almost raw in the uncertain light. Like these. I tied her hair back in two little ponytails. Now she had her ribbons. She had her black dog. The sunflowers had relocated a few feet north, but they were there. Everything was more or less the way it was supposed to be. Thunder blasted. Somewhere close a tree fell, and the lights went out. After 5 seconds of dark gray shadows, they came on again. I carried Kai back to the kitchen
and when we passed the cellar door, something laughed behind it. I heard it. Kai did, too. I could see it in her eyes. "Take care of me," she said. "Take care of me, 'cause I'm just a little guy. You promised."
"I will."
"I love you, Mike."
"I love you, too, Kai."
The kettle was huffing. I filled the cup to the halfway mark with hot water, then topped it up with milk, cooling it off and making it richer. I took Kyra over to the couch. As we passed the dining room table, I glanced at the IBM typewriter and at the manuscript with the crossword puzzle book lying on top of it. Those things looked vaguely foolish and somehow sad, like gadgets that never worked very well and now do not work at all. Lightning lit up the entire sky, scouring the room with purple light. In that glare, the laboring trees looked like screaming fingers, and as the light raced across the sliding glass door to the deck, I saw a woman standing behind us by the wood stove. She was indeed wearing a straw hat with a brim the size of a cartwheel. "What do you mean the river is almost in the sea?" Kai asked. I sat down and handed her the cup. "Drink that up." "Why did the men hurt my mommy? Didn't they want her to have a good time?"
"I guess not," I said.
I began to cry. I held her on my lap, wiping away the tears with the backs of my hands. "You should have taken some sad pills, too," Kai said. She held out her cocoa. Her hair ribbons, which I had tied in big sloppy bows, bobbed. "Here, drink some."
I drank some.
From the north end of the house came another grinding, crackling crash. The low rumble of the generator stuttered and the house went gray again. Shadows raced across Kai's small face. "Hold on," I told her. "Try not to be scared. Maybe the lights will come back." A moment later they did, although now I could hear a hoarse, uneven note in the Jenny's roar, and the flicker of the lights was much more noticeable. "Tell me a story," she said. "Tell me about Cinderbell."
"Cinderella."
"Yeah, her."
"All right, but story guys get paid."
I pursed my lips and made sipping sounds. She held the cup out. The cocoa was sweet and good. The sensation of being watched was heavy and not sweet at all, but let them watch. Let them watch while they could. "There was this pretty girl named Cinderella. Once upon a time, that's how it starts. That's how they all start."
"That's right, I forgot."
"Once upon a time, there was this pretty girl named Cinderella who had two mean old stepsisters. Their names were, do you remember? Tammy Faye and Vanna."
"Yeah, the queens of hairspray. And they made Cinderella do all the really unpleasant chores, like sweeping out the fireplace and cleaning up the dog poop in the backyard. Now, it just so happened that the noted rock band Oasis was going to play a gig at the palace, and although all three of the girls had been invited, I got as far as the part about the fairy godmother catching the mice and turning them into a candy apple red Chevy Nova before the Benadryl took effect. It really was a medicine for sadness. When I looked down, Kai was fast asleep in the crook of my arm, with her cocoa cup listing radically to port. I plucked it from her fingers and put it on the coffee table, then brushed her drying hair off her forehead.
"Kai?"
Nothing.
She'd gone to the land of Naughty Blinky. It probably helped that her afternoon nap had ended almost before it got started. I picked her up and carried her down to the north bedroom, her feet bouncing limply in the air and the hem of the Harley shirt flipping around her knees. I put her on the bed and pulled the duvet up to her chin. Thunder boomed like artillery fire, but she didn't even stir. Exhaustion, grief, Benadryl, they had taken her deep, taken her beyond ghosts and sorrow, and that was good. I bent over and kissed her cheek, which had finally begun to cool. "I'll take care of you," I said. "I promised, and I will." As if hearing me, Kai turned on her side, put the hand holding Strickland under her jaw, and made a soft, sighing sound. Her lashes were dark soot against her cheeks, in startling contrast to her light hair. Looking at her, I felt myself swept by love, shaken by it the way one is shaken by a sickness. take care of me. I'm just a little guy. I will, Kai Bird, I said. I went into the bathroom and began filling the tub, as I had once filled it in my sleep. She would sleep through it all if I could get enough warm water before the generator quit entirely. I wished I had a bath toy to give her in case she did wake up, something like Wilhelm, the spouting veil. But she'd have her dog, and she probably wouldn't wake up anyway. No freezing baptism under a hand pump for Kyra. I was not cruel, and I was not crazy. I had only disposable razors in the medicine cabinet, no good for the other job ahead of me, not efficient enough. But one of the kitchen steak knives would do. If I filled the wash basin with water that was really hot, I wouldn't even feel it. A letter T on each arm, the top bar drawn across the wrists. For a moment, I came out of the zone. A voice, my own, speaking as some combination of Joe and Maddie, screamed, "What are you thinking about? Oh, Mike, what in God's name are you thinking about?" Then the thunder boomed, the lights flickered, and the rain began to pour down again, driven by the wind. I went back into that place where everything was clear, my course indisputable. Let it all in, the sorrow, the hurt, the fear. I didn't want to think anymore about how Maddie had danced with her toes on the frisbee as if it was a spotlight. I didn't want to be there when Kyra woke up, didn't want to see the misery fill her eyes. I didn't want to get through the night ahead, the day that was coming beyond it, or the day that was coming after that. They were all cars on the same old mystery train. Life was a sickness. I was going to give her a nice warm bath and cure her of it. I raised my arms. In the medicine cabinet mirror, a murky figure, a shape, raised its own in a kind of jocular greeting. It was me. It had been me all along, and that was all right. That was just fine.
Only warm, left-hearted bastard dare to touch that little bird.
I dropped to one knee and checked the water. It was coming in nice and warm. Good. Even if the generator quit now, it would be fine. The tub was an old one, a deep one. As I walked down to the kitchen to get the knife, I thought about climbing in with her after I had finished cutting my wrists in the hotter water of the basin. No, I decided. It might be misinterpreted by the people who would come here later on, people with nasty minds and nastier assumptions, the ones who'd come when the storm was over and the trees across the road cleared away. No, after her bath, I would dry her and put her back in bed with Strickland in her hand. I'd sit across the room from her in the rocking chair by the bedroom windows. I would spread some towels in my lap to keep as much of the blood off my pants as I could, and eventually I would go to sleep too. Bunter's bell was still ringing, much louder now. It was getting on my nerves, and if it kept on that way, it might even wake the baby. I decided to pull it down and silence it for good. I crossed the room, and as I did, a strong gust of air blew past me. It wasn't a draft from the broken kitchen window. This was that warm subway air again. It blew the Tough Stuff crossword book onto the floor, but the paperweight on the manuscript kept the loose pages from following. As I looked in that direction, Bunter's bell fell silent. A voice sighed across the dim room, words I couldn't make out. And what did they matter? What did one more manifestation, one more blast of hot air from the great beyond, matter? Thunder rolled, and the sigh came again. This time, as the generator died and the lights went out, plunging the room into gray shadow, I got one word in the clear. 19. I turned on my heels, making a nearly complete circle. I finished up, looking across the shadowy room at the manuscript of My Childhood Friend. Suddenly, the light broke. Understanding arrived. Not the crossword book. Not the phone book, either. My book. My manuscript. I crossed to it, vaguely aware that the water had stopped running into the tub in the north wing bathroom. When the generator died, the pump had quit. That was all right. It would be plenty deep enough already, and warm. I would give Kyra her bath, but first there was something I had to do. I had to go down 19, and after that, I just might have to go down 92. And I could. I had completed just over 120 pages of manuscript, so I could. I grabbed the battery-powered lantern from the top of the cabinet, where I still kept several hundred actual vinyl records, clicked it on, and set it on the table. It cast a white circle of radiance on the manuscript. In the gloom of that afternoon, it was as bright as a spotlight. On page 19 of My Childhood Friend, Tiffy Taylor, the call girl who had reinvented herself as Regina Whiting, was sitting in her studio with Andy Drake, reliving the day that John Sanborn, the alias under which John Shackelford had been getting by, saved her 3-year-old daughter, Karen. This is the passage I read as the thunder boomed and the rain slashed against the sliding doors giving on the deck. Friend, by Noonan, page 19. Over that way, I was sure of it, she said. But when I couldn't see her anywhere, I went to look in the hot tub. She lit a cigarette. What I saw made me feel like screaming, Andy. Karen was underwater. All that was out was her hand. The nails were turning purple. After that, I guess I dived in, but I don't remember. I was zoned out. Everything from then on is like a dream where stuff runs together in your mind. The yard guy, Sanborn, shoved me aside and dived. His foot hit me in the throat, and I couldn't swallow for a week. He yanked up on Karen's arm. I thought he'd pull it off her damn shoulder, but he got her. He got her. In the gloom, Drake saw she was weeping. God, oh God, I thought she was dead. I was sure she was. I knew it once, but laid my steno pad along the left margin of the manuscript so I could see it better. Reading down, as you'd read a vertical crossword puzzle answer, the first letter of each line spelled the message, which had been there almost since I began the book. Owls under stud O. Then, allowing for the indent 2 lines from the bottom, Owls under studio. Bill Dean, my caretaker, is sitting behind the wheel of his truck. He has accomplished his 2 purposes in coming here, welcoming me back to the TR and warning me off Maddie DeVore. Now he's ready to go. He smiles at me, displaying those big false teeth, those Roebuckers. If you get a chance, you want to look for the owls, he tells me. Them plastic owls. I ask him what Joe would have wanted with a couple of plastic owls, and he replies that they keep the crows from shitting up the woodwork. I accept that. I have other things to think about, but still. It was like she come down to do that errand special, he says. It never crosses my mind, not then at least, that in Indian folklore owls have another purpose. They are said to keep evil spirits away. If Joe knew that plastic owls would scare the crows off, she would have known that. It was just the sort of information she picked up and tucked away. My brilliant scatterbrain. My superstitious wife. Thunder rolled. Lightning ate at the clouds like spills of bright acid. I stood by the dining room table with the manuscript in my unsteady hands. Christ, Joe, I whispered. What did you find out? And why didn't you tell me? But I thought I knew the answer to that. She hadn't told me because I was somehow like Max DeVore. His great-grandfather and my own had shit in the same pit. It didn't make any sense, but there it was. And she hadn't told her own brother either. I took a weird kind of comfort from that. I began to leaf through the manuscript, my skin crawling. Andy Drake rarely frowned in Michael Noonan's My Childhood Friend. He scowled instead, because there's an owl in every scowl. Before coming to Florida, John Shackelford had been living in Studio City, California. Drake's first meeting with Regina Whiting occurred in her studio, Ray Garrity's last known address was the Studio Apartments in Key Largo. Regina Whiting's best friend was Steffi Underwood. Steffi's husband was Toll Underwood. There was a good one, two for the price of one. Owls under Studio. It was everywhere, on every page, just like the K-names in the telephone book. A kind of monument. This one built, I was sure of it, not by Sarah Tidwell, but by Joanna Arlen Noonan. My wife passing messages behind the guard's back, praying with all her considerable heart that I would see and understand. On page 92, Shackelford was talking to Drake in the prison visitor's room, sitting with his wrists between his knees, looking down at the chain running between his ankles, refusing to make eye contact with Drake. Friend, by Noonan, page 92. Only thing I got to say. Anything else? Fuck, what good would it do? Life's a game, and I lost. You want me to tell you that I yanked some little kid out of the water, pulled her up, got her motor going again? I did, but not because I'm a hero or a saint. And down the left-hand margin, O-W-L-S-U-N. Owls un... There was more, but no need to read it. The message, Owls Under Studio, ran down the margin just as it had on page 19, as it probably did on any number of other pages as well. I remembered how deliriously happy I had been to discover that the block had been dissolved and I could write again. It had been dissolved all right, but not because I'd finally beaten it or found a way around it. Joe had dissolved it. Joe had beaten it, and my continued career as a writer of second-rate thrillers had been the least of her concerns when she did it. As I stood there in the flicker flash of lightning, feeling my unseen guests swirl around me in the unsteady air, I remembered Mrs. Moran, my first-grade teacher. When one's efforts to replicate the smooth curves of the Palmer Method alphabet on the blackboard began to flag and waver, she would put her large, competent hand over yours and help you. So had Joe helped me. I riffled through the manuscript and saw the keywords everywhere, sometimes placed so you could actually read them stacked on different lines, one above the other. How hard she had tried to tell me this, and I had no intention of doing anything else until I found out why. I dropped the manuscript back on the table, but before I could re-anchor it, a furious gust of freezing air blew past me, lifting the pages and scattering them everywhere in a cyclone. If that force could have ripped them to shreds, I'm sure that it would have. No, it cried as I grabbed the lantern's handle. No, finish the job. Wind blew around my face in chill gusts. It was as if someone I couldn't quite see was standing right in front of me and breathing in my face, retreating as I moved forward, huffing and puffing like the big bad wolf outside the houses of the three little pigs. I hung the lantern over my arm, held my hands out in front of me, and clapped them together sharply. The cold puffs in my face ceased. There was now only the random swirling air coming in through the partially plugged kitchen window. "She's sleeping," I said to what I knew was still there, silently watching. "There's time." I went out the back door, and the wind took me at once, making me stagger sideways, almost knocking me over. And in the wavering trees, I saw green faces, the faces of the dead. DeVore's was there, and Royce's, and Son Tidwell's. Most of all, I saw Sarah's. Everywhere, Sarah. "No, go back. You don't need no truck with no owls, sugar. Go back. Finish the job. Do what you came for." "I don't know what I came for," I said, "and until I find out, I'm not doing anything." The wind screamed as if in offense, and a huge branch split off the pine standing to the right of the house. It fell on top of my Chevrolet in a spray of water, denting the roof before rolling off on my side. Clapping my hands out here would be every bit as useful as King Canute commanding the tide to turn. This was her world, not mine. And only the edge of it at that. Every step closer to the street and the lake would bring me closer to that world's heart, where time was thin and spirits ruled. Oh, dear God, what had happened to cause this?
The path to Joe's studio had turned into a creek. I got a dozen steps down it before a rock turned under my foot and I fell heavily on my side. Lightning zigged across the sky. There was the crack of another breaking branch, and then something was falling toward me. I put my hands up to shield my face and rolled to the right, off the path. The branch splashed to the ground just behind me, and I tumbled halfway down a slope that was slick with soaked needles. At last, I was able to pull myself to my feet. The branch on the path was even bigger than the one that had landed on the roof of the car. If it had struck me, it likely would have bashed in my skull. "Go back!" A hissing, spiteful wind through the trees. "Finish it!" The slobbering, guttural voice of the lake, slamming into the rocks and the bank below the street. "Mind your business!" That was the very house itself, groaning on its foundations. "Mind your business and let me mind mine." But Kyra was my business. Kyra was my daughter. I picked up the lantern. The housing was cracked, but the bulb glowed bright and steady. That was one for the home team. Bent over against the howling wind, hand raised to ward off more falling branches, I slipped and stumbled my way down the hill to my dead wife's studio.
Hold a child way down with so many secrets to keep.